His arrogance was really rather extraordinary. It was amusing, and it was also irritating. "I'm a registered Democrat," I said. "That's something you might want to include in your dossier on me. And I have to say that you're remarkably confident for someone who's about to run against a 40-year incumbent." Rather than being insulted, Charlie appeared delighted. "I always appreciate someone who's done her research," he said. "You know who does seem like ideal wife material?" He pointed toward me. "You're ridiculous," I said. "How is it that a woman as lovely as you hasn't been snapped up by now?" "Maybe I don't want to be snapped up," I said. "Did that occur to you?"
Welcome to Book Tour. I am Netta Ulibi. Author Curtis Settenfeld reads this week from her new novel, American Wife. It's a lightly fictionalized story of a certain first lady whose initials might be Laura Bush. Settenfeld says she identifies with Mrs. Bush as a voracious reader. The author describes herself as a staunch Democrat, but a few years ago, Settenfeld published an admiring essay about the first lady in the online magazine Salon. That was back when Settenfeld was teaching English at one of Washington, D.C.'s most exclusive private schools. Such a setting provided the backdrop for Settenfeld's first novel, Prep, also about a young woman assessing a privileged world from an outsider's point of view. American Wife has been widely praised by reviewers, both liberal and conservative. Joyce Carol Oates in the New York Times called it amiable and occasionally provocative. The conservative New York Sun described it as vastly entertaining. This reading of American Wife took place in September 2008 at the Politics and Prose Bookstore in Washington, D.C.
This book is about a young woman. Well, she sort of ages drastically, but she starts out actually as a girl named Alice. She grows up in Wisconsin. She's born in the 40s. As you may or may not have heard, she goes on to become First Lady of the United States. And it basically, if there's four sections at four different times in her life. And in this section, it's 1977, and she's 31. And let's see, it's Madison, Wisconsin. Her best friend is named Dina. And Dina is interested in this young man named Charlie Blackwell, and who is from a sort of big, fancy political family. And so they've gone to this barbecue where Dina hopes to kind of catch Charlie's eye. And what happens instead is that Charlie kind of hits on Alice, asks her out. She declines. But then Dina basically gets so drunk that she passes out. And so Alice leaves by herself. Oh, and one other thing. So Alice is a teacher librarian, and her project this summer has been that she's making papier-mâché figures of characters from children's books for when school starts again in the fall. And she's kind of obsessed with the project, and so she lives in a sort of small apartment, and so she's no longer sleeping in her bedroom. She's given it over to her papier-mâché figures, and she's sleeping in the living room. But she's also kind of doing it in secret. I had gone half a block when I heard quick footsteps behind me. I turned, and over my shoulder, I saw Charlie Blackwell. "Got somewhere better to be?" he asked. "I'm pretty sure things were winding down," I said. "Fair enough," he said. "Can I offer you a ride?" It was buggy out. I tried to scrutinize his face, which, in the glow cast by the streetlight a few yards away, was both flushed and sallow. "How many drinks have you had?" I asked. "You're certainly direct," he said. Since high school, I had never ridden in a car with a driver who might be so much as tipsy. "You know what?" I said. "I'll walk, but it was nice to meet you." When I turned around again, Charlie stayed beside me. "You've at least got to let me escort you," he said. "There's only so much rejection a fellow can withstand in one night, Alice." We continued walking, and he said, "I take it you're not afraid of the dark?" I gave him a sidelong glance. "Are you joking?" He said, "I'll tell you a secret, but you've got to promise not to repeat it. You promise?" Without waiting for my reply, he said, "I'm terrified of the dark. Scares the living bejesus out of me. My parents have a place up in Door County, and I'd rather chew off my own leg than spend the night there alone." "What are you so afraid of?" I asked. "That's just it," he said. "You have no idea what's out there. But hey, you know what? I'm not scared right now, and it's because you're beside me. Dainty as you are, you seem extraordinarily capable. If something terrible befell us, I'm sure you'd take care of it. I said, do you always lavish compliments on women you hardly know? Hardly know you? Good God, I thought we were old friends by now. He brought his hand to his heart as if wounded, then made a rapid recovery. Here's what I've got. Number one, you just bought a house by yourself, which means you're independent and financially solvent. Number two, you're already getting your school papers together, even though it's July, which means you're responsible. That's the excuse she gave him for not going on a date. Or you're a liar, but I'm giving you the benefit of the doubt. He was raising one finger for each point. Number three, you're a Cracker Jack charades player. This was untrue. My enactment of The Sound of Music had been particularly abysmal. Number four, either you have a boyfriend but are pretending not to because of your overpowering attraction to me, or you don't have a boyfriend and are letting me down easy. Whichever it is, these are challenges I'm willing to surmount. In conclusion, I know all about you. As we walked, I could feel Charlie looking at me, grinning. I understand you. I sense a long and happy future for the two of us, and I'm sure you sense it too. Oh, but you have to like baseball. You like baseball? I wouldn't say I'm a diehard fan, I said. You will be. Charlie swung an imaginary bat through the air. The Brewers are finally pulling it together. A lot of young talent on the team, and you mark my words, this could be a winning season. Truthfully, I said, the only reason I went to the Hickens party tonight was to help Dina catch your eye. Dina? He sounded puzzled. You mean the divorcee? Who told you that? I said. No, never mind. Dina's a wonderful person. She was a flight attendant for more than 5 years, and she's traveled the country. Yet she still hasn't learned to hold her liquor, he said. She didn't have much to eat, I said. That's why. I'll tell you what, he said. You can look at her face and know she's done some hard living, but who am I to throw stones? She seems like a perfectly nice girl. But she does not, if you catch my meaning, strike me as marriage material for a rising star of the Republican Party. Oh, I forgot to tell you something crucial. He's running for Congress. He's 31. His arrogance was really rather extraordinary. It was amusing, and it was also irritating. I'm a registered Democrat, I said. That's something you might want to include in your dossier on me. And I have to say that you're remarkably confident for someone who's about to run against a 40-year incumbent. Rather than being insulted, Charlie appeared delighted. I always appreciate someone who's done her research, he said. You know who does seem like ideal wife material? He pointed toward me. You're ridiculous, I said. How is it that a woman as lovely as you hasn't been snapped up by now? Maybe I don't want to be snapped up, I said. Did that occur to you? Needless to say, I wanted it very much. I wanted to get married and sleep in a bed with a man at night. I wanted to hold his hand while walking downtown, to prepare the meals for him that were too much trouble for one person, roast beef and lasagna. I wanted children, and I knew I would be a good mother, not perfect, but good. And I'd already decided I wouldn't let my daughters have hair longer than chin length, because I'd seen in my students how it made them vain, the maintenance of one's locks as a family project. Still, despite all this, it felt gratifying to lie to Charlie Blackwell. Don't tell me you're one of those feminists, he said. You couldn't be because you're too pretty. I stared at him. That's not even worth dignifying, and frankly, I'm not sure why my romantic status is your business. Oh, it's most definitely my business, he said. It's my business because I'm bewitched by you. Part of the reason he was frustrating was that his comments were so close to what I wanted to hear from a man, but I wanted them to be real. I yearned for genuine emotion, not this banter and jest. When we arrived in front of the house where I lived, Charlie said, I think you ought to invite me in for a cup of coffee. There's a rumor that I'm drunk. I shook my head in exasperation and let him follow me into the small entry hall and up the carpeted stairs to the second floor. He stood behind me as I unlocked the door to my apartment. In the kitchen, I went to turn on the coffee maker when he said, you got any beer? Because if it's all the same to you, I'd prefer it. I pulled two cans of Pabst from the refrigerator and passed him one. When we'd pulled the tabs off, he tipped his can toward mine. To Alice, he said, a woman of beauty, virtue, and outstanding taste in alcohol. Has anyone ever told you you're relentless, I asked, and then I watched in horror as he walked out of the kitchen, down the hall, and toward the bedroom where I worked on my book characters. Please don't go in, I started to say, but he was well ahead of me and obviously not listening. Besides, the door to the room was open. When I caught up with him, he was standing in the room center, turning to look at the papier-mâché figures one by one. "They're for the library where I work," I said, and my voice was loud in the silence. I couldn't imagine how he'd react to the characters, or even how I wanted him to. He was not, I reminded myself, the intended audience. He was quiet for a full minute, and then, in a completely serious tone, he said, "These are amazing." I swallowed. I recognized Ferdinand. He pointed to the bull with flowers woven around his horns. "And that's Mike Mulligan and his steam shovel, Marianne." "They're not exactly to scale," I said. I was madly in love with Marianne. He grinned. "I just knew they'd be able to dig that cellar in one day. Oh, and Eloise. I always thought she was a pain in the ass." "Girls like her more than boys," I said. "Who's that?" He motioned with his chin toward the corner of the room where bright green leaves, I'd cut them from a bolt of lurid silk fabric, hung atop a brown trunk. "The Giving Tree," I said. "It's a book published when we were in high school, assuming, well, how old are you?" 31, he said, class of 1964. "Me too. That's the year The Giving Tree came out. It's my favorite book. I've probably read it 70 times, and the end still always makes me cry." Just describing the book, I could hear my voice thickening with emotion, and I felt embarrassed. "Why would you want to cry 70 times?" Charlie said. But his tone was sweet, not mocking. He gestured to his right. "Who's the Chinaman?" "That's Tiki Tiki Tembo," I said. "He's a boy who falls down a well, and everyone who tries to get help for him has to repeat his name, which is really long. As some of you might know, this is an un-PC book, but the characters don't know it because it's 1977. Tiki Tiki Tembo is actually the short version. His whole name is, trust me, it's long. "Now you have to say it," Charlie said. "Really?" I said. He nodded. I took a breath. I rarely talked about my job when I was out on dates, though this was not, of course, a date. "Tiki Tiki Tembo, No Sorembo, Cherry Berry Ruchi, Pipberry Pembo," I said, and when I finished, we were smiling at each other. "One more time," he said. I complied, and he said, "That's most impressive." I bowed. "Those kids you teach must be nuts about you," he said. "Well, I'm no fool," I said. "Students start rebelling against their teachers in junior high, but in elementary school, they're fighting to sit on your lap." He regarded me. He was still in the center of the room, and I was just inside the door. And the only way I can describe the expression on his face is to say it was one of enchantment. I had no idea why, but Charlie Blackwell found me enchanting. And I recognized, with a pang that was at once sorrow, remorse, and the first stirring of hope, that it was a way no one had looked at me since Andrew Imhoff. In the last 14 years, I had been on plenty of dates, I'd been in relationships, I'd even been proposed to, but there was nobody I'd enchanted. "Alice, what would you do if I kissed you right now?" Charlie said. We looked at each other, and the room was filled with shyness and promise. After a long time, I said, "If you want to find out, I guess you'll have to try." And I'm going to stop reading there. I have multiple family members in the audience, and I wouldn't read anything disgusting anyway. But I went on a paperback reading tour, and my brother, who was then in college, came with me for part of it. And he sort of had these rules for if he was going to accompany me. One, I had to read a different section every night so he didn't get bored. Two, he's glaring at me. Two, I had to announce that he was single and eligible because I was going to a lot of colleges. And three, if I read anything that was like at all a sex scene, I had to stop before it got, you know, repulsive. So I think those are generally good rules to live by. Anyway, if anyone has questions, I would be happy to try to answer them. So the question is, how did I imagine the book in order to create it? The book is loosely inspired by the life of Laura Bush. And it actually is loose. I mean, I have sort of, I'm a Democrat, I'm very liberal, but I've always been intrigued by Laura Bush, like pretty much since George Bush took office. And I've actually always really liked her. And partly I read articles about her that were sort of surprising or made her seem different from what I thought. And I mean, just a few details that stuck out were, as you know, First Lady of Texas, and then early on, although I don't think this really continued, but early on in the White House, she would invite writers who had, you know, sort of gone on the record as having differing political opinions from her husband. She would invite them to these kind of literary events or discussions, and a lot of them would think, oh, you know, sort of Mrs. Bush with her kind of pseudo-literary pretensions, and she has no idea of these books that we've written, et cetera, et cetera. And then they would show up, and they would find out that, in fact, she'd read all their books. She had knowingly invited them. So that was a very intriguing detail. Of course, she's a huge fiction reader, and there's nothing more endearing to a fiction writer than a fiction reader. But she also, you know, just some of the details that stood out. She was apparently at parties at the governor's mansion. One, I think that she maybe had no formal big black tie events when she was there, but a lot of times at parties, supposedly, she would go out and play with the dogs outside, like while the party was going on. She would fly southwest around Texas to visit her friends. Her closest friends are supposed to be this group of women from elementary school. Also, one of my favorite stories is that she was, one time, I think when she was, again, First Lady of Texas, someone ran into her in the post office and said, "What are you doing here?" And she said, "I'm mailing a letter." And I always liked that. Anyway, so I always was intrigued by her. And then in 2004, I read a book by a Washington Post then writer, now editor, named Anne Gerhart, called The Perfect Wife, which I highly recommend to anyone who sort of wants to, one, just read a biography of Laura Bush, or like sort out fact and fiction. It was very influential to me in writing this book. And so at that time, I read the book. I wrote an article for the online magazine Salon, basically saying Laura Bush's life is like a novel. And then literally 2.5 years passed. And then I thought, you know, wait. and also, I'm kind of a secretive writer, and I would never have knowingly written that article and basically posted my outline for my novel on Salon years before I started writing it. So I kind of took four big events in Mrs. Bush's life, to answer your original question, and there's four sections, four big events, and then I invented everything else. And so the vast majority of characters, situations, plot lines, dialogue, and of course, to me, it's all made up because, you know, for example, it's sort of common knowledge that George Bush, at some point around the age of 40, quit drinking and became religious. But I wasn't there. And so even if I think, okay, if I take this bit of fact and then weave it into the book, it has to be made up. It's almost the equivalent for anyone in this room. If you told me the story of, like, how your parents met, and then I wrote a short story, you know, I would have drawn from something real, but it would be very invented. So, obviously, in terms of using your imagination, I think that's just what fiction writers are supposed to do. At some point, obviously, I just started feverishly making things up, but okay, I promise not to give, that was kind of like the introductory answer. They won't all be that long, I hope. Okay, in the back. The question is, Laura Bush had a car accident when she was 17, where she was driving, she ran a stop sign, she hit another car, it was being driven by a classmate of hers, and he died. And the question is, what I think is that what sort of made me fascinated at first? I think that what made me fascinated about her life in general is that she seems like a really sincerely kind person. Everyone says this who has met her, who has, you know, all the books about her, and there's plenty of articles, biographies, et cetera, out there. And in some ways, she seems almost like a reserved or quiet person who's ended up leading this very extreme, unusual life. And I do feel like that car accident that she had is a very sort of, I mean, tragic, but also an extreme thing to happen. And I think I did think, what would the effect be on someone to have that happen? And especially, I mean, she was an only child. And also, I changed this in the book, but it was very shortly before Kennedy's death. So, I mean, it just seems like it must have been such a, you know, kind of heightened, terrible time. But that's not the only extreme, unusual event in her life. Another thing that was really interesting to me is that she and George Bush, so they met, they were, I think she was 30, he was 31. It was 1977 in Texas. And they got engaged within 6 weeks of meeting and then married within 6 weeks of getting engaged. So, and apparently they had sort of been circling each other for years, and some friends, I think, had wanted to set her up, and she had said she didn't want to because he sounded like he was a really political person, or, you know, he came from a really political family. So do I have any comment from the White House? There have been, well, I actually thought of sending a book and or a letter to Mrs. Bush, and then I just thought, I mean, no matter what, I mean, I don't know if it would really even make it to her, but it would probably come out wrong or seem like, I don't know, that it was a manipulative gesture somehow. I was doing it so I could talk about it, but now I can just talk about it without having done it. But I think in two articles that have been written sort of about the book's publication, the reporter called the White House, and the White House, Mrs. Bush's spokesperson, said, I believe she said that she doesn't plan, she, the spokesperson, doesn't plan to read the book. And I think she also said Mrs. Bush doesn't plan to read the book. And then she said, we don't comment on fictional characters, which I actually feel like is a relatively diplomatic thing to say, you know. So, I mean, I kind of doubt that. Like, a lot of people say, oh, do you think that Laura Bush will read it? And I would say probably not, because, again, so much is written about the Bushes. It's not like if a book was written about me or someone who's sort of not a public figure, and where you'd think, you know, what does it say? Or it's, I just think that she's busy. But again, if she does read it, I would love to know what she thought, you know, even if it's several years from now. So the question in the book, the characters, the Blackwell family has a sort of summer vacation home in northern Wisconsin. It's called Halcyon. And the question is, how did I get it so right? Well, I have been in some summer homes, and I think a lot of them, I mean, actually, when I wrote Prep, you know, it was set at a boarding school, and a lot of times people would say to me, oh, did you do research at Exeter? You know, did you do research at Andover, whatever? And I hadn't, you know, I had gone to a boarding school. And I think that a lot of boarding schools feel like they're very distinct and that they have their own kind of rituals, but they're a lot alike. You know, there's a huge amount of overlap. And I suspect the same is true of summer homes, especially among affluent people, where a lot of them are sort of pretend rustic or voluntarily rustic. And in this one, there's something like 30 people sharing one bathroom, and Alice goes in there, and, you know, she's new to the family, and I did, so, and actually, some I think reviewers or have thought, what could possibly have made you do this? But there is a scene where she has some stomach trouble, and it, which is kind of heightened by the fact that there's one bathroom and 30 people. And a friend of mine read this book before it came out, a writer, and she said, basically, almost like there's this saying, I think it's attributed to Chekhov, that if you have a gun in the first scene, or in the first act, it has to go off by the third act. And she said, if you have this sort of sensitive toilet that's introduced, like, it has to break down. And so I'll let you read the book and see whether I followed her advice. But anyway, other... did I feel any sense of responsibility writing about someone who's in the White House now and who's a real person, or did I feel like that can be dismissed by saying, oh, this is a novel? Yes, I did feel some sense of responsibility. And I'm sure that there are people who think that writing this book was like an inappropriate or disrespectful thing to do. I think, honestly, I think probably more people who haven't read the book think that than people who have. But I don't think, I wouldn't have written this book if I didn't have this sort of affection and admiration for Laura Bush. And I think there are a lot of satires of the Bushes out there, and a lot of pop, you know, there's the TV show Lil Bush, which I've only ever, I think I've seen the sort of ads for it, and they're really funny, but I think that if you ever watch the show, it's like you just should stick to the ads. Like, that's enough to give you the idea of it. But there's lots of other things that I think portray the Bushes as very sort of one-dimensional, and in a weird way, I think there, somebody basically said to me, this book is such a violation because everything in it is so plausible and so believable. And I thought that was, in a way, I almost thought, thank you, you know. But I feel like, you know, oh, is it more respectful to sort of treat someone as a kind of flat, one-dimensional person and to not acknowledge that they're complicated? And so obviously I made the choice to write the book, so I feel like comfortable having done it. But I can see, one, why people would think you shouldn't. And two, I would not write a book about someone that I hated. One, when you write a book, it takes so long and you're with these people all day. So you don't want to sort of be in the presence of people you don't like. But two, I wouldn't want to be working from a place of sort of mockery rather than kind of sympathy or sincerity. So the question is, if there's an author who inspired me to start writing or why I wanted to start writing. Well, I was one of those people who actually, as soon as I learned to read and write, which I think was in kindergarten, I always did. And I never stopped, which is, I think that a lot of people do write when they're little. And then some people, you know, pick it up again as adults. So I don't know. I mean, some of the children's books, not all of these that get mentioned, are books that I love. Like, I loved the Eloise books, which in some ways I feel like, of course, the person who grew up to write prep loved the Eloise books, because those two, in retrospect, are very sort of like kind of celebrating elitism in a way. But they're really fun too. My parents read the Laura Ingalls Wilder books out loud to us, and we loved those. And I think in some ways, I've become a much more finicky reader as I've gotten older, which is a shame. But my favorite writer now is Alice Munro, the Canadian short story writer. And I sort of feel like, well, I mean, actually, lately, she's kind of taken this turn where she writes about sort of dark, kind of crimey things that I don't love, but she's still like the best writer in the world. You know, and I'd read anything she wrote. So I love Alice Munro. Okay, thank you for coming.
Thanks for joining us on Book Tour. For more readings and discussions like this one, please visit npr.org/booktour.